Ukraine is never going to get all their land back, are they?
I cannot see any possibility of that happening right now. I'm afraid having diversity for its own sake does not actually add any fighting capability whatsoever.
Are we sleepwalking because of our weak leadership into World War III without realising it?
We're at war with Russia now. Nobody's realised it.
Rear Admiral Dr. Chris Parry, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So just to give you a quick introduction, you served in the Falklands, sunk the first submarine from a helicopter, had lots of service, and obviously you're a Rear Admiral in the Royal Navy. So we just want to get straight into it. Are we going to war with Russia?
Well, it's a choice. It's a choice on both sides, whether Russia sees it in its interest to go to war with the United Kingdom and or NATO, and whether we have the weakness to provoke Russia into essentially taking reckless actions. Right now, without the Americans being at the heart of NATO, there is no doubt that Russia would engage in serious adventurism, particularly in the area of the Baltic and the Black Seas.
What do you mean by weakness? Because I thought that would be like, because I just find that strange. So weakness of provoking Russia, but it, wouldn't that be normally viewed as strength?
No, essentially, if you want to deter aggression and political adventurism, you actually have to put up a decent defence, a credible defence. If you talk to the Israelis, they will say that weakness or any perceived weakness in political will or military capability are provocations. You invite the other side to attack you. If you go back to the ancient Greek world, it was considered during the Peloponnesian War that the causes of wars were either fear, you actually feared what somebody else would do to you, interest, you could get something out of it, or indeed the culture of a society was fundamentally militaristic or aggressive. And if you look at all the wars that have been caused in the past, it'll be down to one of those three things.
But, and this is probably caused by fear, isn't it? Russia feared NATO expansion into Eastern Europe. Is that fair to say?
No, John, I think this is a common myth. NATO doesn't expand. People join NATO because they fear one of the three things we just talked about. And the fear was really of either an unstable Russia or an aggressive one. And of course, when you listen to Russian politicians today, particularly those who are associated with the Putin clique in the Kremlin, they're always talking about this tiny collection of states on the end of their continent called Europe. Yeah. And Russia traditionally likes to look both ways, towards Europe and towards Asia. And it's symbolized by the fact, if you look on the Russian coat of arms, there's a double-headed eagle. It looks both ways.
Oh, right.
And so when it looks towards Europe, it wants to be like us, but really wants to dominate us. When it looks east, it's sort of imperial. It has an imperial approach to the way it wants to deal with Central Asia, Siberia, and all these other places. I mean, the really interesting thing about today's world is that we're returning to imperial postures again. Russia's seeking to recreate the empire of Catherine the Great. And Putin, at the start of the Ukraine conflict, was always giving speeches in front of statues of Catherine the Great. And every Russian knew what that meant. Ukraine was part of this greater design to advance the Russian imperial project. If you look at China today, China is absolutely up front and center trying to recreate the empire of the Ming emperors in the 15th century. The Belt and Road Initiative is shamelessly Ming in its origin. If you look at the Silk Roads from the 15th century, that's what's happening with pipelines, roads, railways across Eurasia. And soon we'll see gridded networks added to that, which will be boosted by nuclear fusion in the 2040s. And you have sea routes through the Indian Ocean to Africa, the Persian Gulf, and all these other places that replicate the routes that were dominated by Chinese warships.
Well,
in the 15th
we'll come back to we'll come back to China a bit later on, because that's certainly part of the conversation. But in respect to Russia, what you're saying is that there is a possibility that war or some kind of conflict between NATO and Russia will happen. I guess then the question is, what are the likely starting points for that? You mentioned imperialism. Obviously, Russia is in a conflict with Ukraine at the moment, but they've certainly got their their hearts and their heads set on Moldova and Georgia potentially. Do you think that's one way that that conflict could escalate?
If you go back to the 1950s, there's a really famous Time magazine cover which has a picture of Western Europe viewed from on top of Moscow looking west. Right. And Khrushchev, who does the commentary at the time, says, look, have a look at this geography. Again, the tiny collection of states on the end of our continent. America's nowhere to be seen. But there are two arms that reach round and strangle Russia. They're called the Mediterranean and the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea. And he says quite explicitly, it is Soviet in those days, now Russian policy, to neutralize threats that come from that direction. So Russia feels threatened by anything that doesn't actually follow their line or is neutral in the Baltic and the Black Sea. Now, just have a think about what happened at the end of the Cold War. Russia lost almost all its beachfront property in the Baltic. All they had left was Kaliningrad, that tiny exclave between Lithuania and Poland, and also the approaches to St. Petersburg, both of which ice up in winter. If you go down into the Black Sea, all they had was a tiny strip of land between Ukraine and Georgia, where Sochi is. And that really upset them, because they couldn't dominate the Baltic and the Black Sea. And as you said, John, you know, as they perceived, and it was a perception, NATO expanding, it wasn't, it was three countries saying, look, we'd like to band together against the big bad wolf. They started thinking, well, how are we going to alter the strategic geometry here? And so we saw a lot of pressure on the Baltic. So you saw a lot of NATO warships and aircraft being harassed by the Russians. And of course, what they've done is captured Crimea and the eastern Donbass region. And they followed that up with the major invasion in 2022. Although the motives for that were a lot more than just strategic geography. You know, the one thing that everybody's missed with Ukraine is that Russia has a declining population. And quite a lot of their writers in Russian, I speak Russian, were saying, look, we need to get 41 million Ukrainians, because they're a lot like us, into our population pool to actually enhance a declining population. They've got a lot of agricultural assets, got a lot of offshore oil and gas, by the way, off Crimea and in the eastern Donbass, which within 10 years could displace Russian gas supplies to Europe. So a lot of reasons for going into Ukraine.
So is it strategic or is it imperialistic?
It's both.
It's both. So do you reckon they're just going for Odessa and...
Oh, right at the start of the Ukraine conflict.
Well, Odessa leads to Moldova, I assume, does
well,
it?
Well, either Moldova leads, or Moldova leads to Odessa, if you can attack from both sides. I mean, true. It depends. So right at the start of the conflict, I sent a WhatsApp message to... our Chief of Defence Staff, Tony Radakin, who's a friend. I said, don't be sucked in by thinking Russia wants the whole of Ukraine. It wants to decapitate the government, make it a friendly government. But what it really wants is the bottom third.
Which is what it's gone for.
Funny old thing. And I can tell you, on day one, I said, this is their agenda, to get all the way across to Moldova, cut Ukraine off from the Black Sea, assure their dominance of the Black Sea. That's the other thing, as I said just now. And that would be it. They'd leave the rump of Ukraine for the EU to pick up, probably.
But that's going to be unacceptable to the Ukrainians, and therefore, at the moment, unacceptable to the West.
That's totally unacceptable for essentially a guarantor of Ukraine's borders after Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons to actually then invade it. Yeah. It's quite extraordinary. But I think what we have to do...
But we're never going to... No, Ukraine is never going to get all their land back, are they?
I cannot see any possibility of that happening right now. And I think the only chance Ukraine had was possibly when they had the ability, well, they didn't have the ability, they had the ambition, not the ability, to punch through to the Sea of Azov or Black Sea in the vicinity of Mariupol or Melitopol. If they'd achieved that, then...
Was this last year?
Yeah, I think... Yeah, exactly.
Counter-offensive.
I think there would have been probably a mutiny in the Russian army. I think Putin was weak at the time. I've been one of those people who believe that since the Ukrainian invasion, Putin actually has just been a front man. There's been a clique in Russia that actually has been controlling him. he's just reasserted that power, I think.
And we've seen some major changes in their top army personnel. It seems that there's been another reorganisation about putting different people in different positions. Right.
You and I call that a purge normally.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact of life is that I think for about a year, 18 months, Putin was just a front man for a clique that probably included Petrushev, ex GRU operator, and his son, the Minister of Agriculture, various crime bosses from St. Petersburg, the military, Shoigu and Gerasimov, and a lot of shadowy people that probably are looking to displace him. But in Russia, you can't really show too early. Otherwise, you fall out of windows.
But that sounds like it's not too bad. I mean, it's awful. Right, I'm not trying to minimise it, but it doesn't sound like it's too much of a threat to us. Like, if they could just invade Ukraine and there'll be some kind of deal with the Donbass, then, you know, that doesn't sound like it's a threat to Ukraine.
It's the principle, John. You know, if you say that armed force can be used as part of modern diplomacy after 1945 in Europe, then you're essentially saying, if I can do it here, I can do it, you know, in the Baltic states.
I can and also, Finland, coming back to what I said again, suddenly the Moldovan people decide they want to be Russian, so bizarrely, and then the Georgians decide, and suddenly then Russia has to go in to support people to free Georgia and free Moldova once they're then taken over.
So what are you saying then? We should send NATO troops into Ukraine?
I'm not saying that, but all I'm saying is that Putin isn't finished, and he's got a thirst for this now. So any success in Ukraine, which he's likely to get, because I don't think the West is strong enough to hold him off, is will then end up with Moldova taken over, Georgia taken over. There's talk of Kazakhstan. I mean, in the east,
he hasn't got an army, Andy.
He has got plenty of people.
The basic problem is that I mean, one of the reasons I think it's good to remain engaged in Ukraine, if I'm being perfectly cynical, is that we're expending probably 5% of our military power in supporting Ukraine, and we're depleting 75% of Russia's ability to fight. Yeah. It's a fantastic proxy war from our point of view, if I'm being totally cynical. But the fact of life is that Russia has an amazing ability to reconstitute itself, and it is able to draw on the military and also military expertise and industrial capacity of China and Iran. I don't think we should underestimate that right now we've got a situation in Europe and Eurasia more generally where Russia, China, Iran and North Korea have between them said, look, we're going to dominate the whole of this continent and the waters around it, and we are going to look after our own interests in a particular area, which is why Russia's leaning on Europe at the moment. You've got Iran leaning on the greater Middle East, and the Israel thing is part of that. And you've got China leaning on the South China Sea, Taiwan, Japan, and all the others. You know, they've agreed on the strategy, and we have to appreciate this. We're not just facing.
You reckon
Russia.
This is organised?
Of course it is. Yeah.
So they've agreed. We'll stretch the West. They can't
keep the United States off balance. We'll start sort of really pressing onto the. Let me put it in geopolitical terms. There's a famous geopolitical thinker called Halford Mackinder. And he said, you've got two major entities in the world. You've got the world island, which is Eurasia, and he said Africa as well. And he said, if you can dominate Eurasia, then you dominate the world. And Hitler said that too. If I can get Lebensraum, if I can get this huge economic and energy entity in Central Asia, then, you know, we can dominate the world. And then there's another geopolitical thinker called Alfred Thayer Mahan. And he said, well, no, that's not true. It's not dominating the world island that's the issue. It's dominating the world ocean. Because the world ocean connects you between commodities, manufacturers and markets. And it's true. In history, maritime alliances always defeat continental alliances.
Well, if it goes back to World War II and the U-boats and the effect that had on the war effort then.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, in a book I wrote in 2014... called Superhighway, I actually said the sea is the physical equivalent of the World Wide Web. Because what goes, if you like, on the internet really goes by sea, including the cables that carry the internet that go under the sea, of course. So it's a very close analogy. So if you're not involved at sea and able to use the sea as you want, you're not involved in any sort of globalization. But what we're seeing, though, is Another geopolitical thinker called Nicholas Spykman said, yeah, I hear you about the world ocean and the world island. All the conflicts are going to be in the gap between the two. So he said Rimland, which is where...
What's Rimland?
Where, Rimland is where, you know, the world ocean meets the world island. You're going to see all the conflicts. So in the gap. So what I've said...
So like the Gulf, the South China Sea and Taiwan.
They're all in Rimland. What I've been saying recently, and I firmly believe this, is the world is splitting into two blocks. One is the Eurasian autocrats, India, Russia, China, Iran and North Korea, and what I call the maritime democracies, United States, Canada, parts of Europe, not all of it, United Kingdom, obviously, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, and within 5 years, India will be part of that. But outside of that, you've got 152 in between us who are trying to make up their minds where their interests lie.
And they're slowly being sucked up by China, and China, especially in Africa, has made great.
Yeah, Andy, it depends. If you want security, you tend towards the maritime democracies. If you want development, you're tending towards the BRICS countries and the Eurasian autocrats. And that's where the fight is now for the next 30 years. In this rimland between the two blocks.
I would, when I look at the world and the political world, I think our leaders are pretty weak. I think the European Union's pretty weak. We've obviously got a weak leader in the UK. America certainly has a weak leader. And there seems to be all of these kind of threats that's going on. Obviously, Russia's expansion into Europe. Again, there is talk of, obviously, border crossing firing between the Egyptians and the Israelis only a few days ago. We've got a semi-blockade of Taiwan practiced by the Chinese only last week. Are we sleepwalking because of our weak leadership into World War III without realising it?
I think there are a number of issues. I think it's a broader cultural issue than that. I think we've been fat, dumb and happy for the last 70 years, you know, and we got complacent. We've got leaders who are beholden to electorates every 5 years. Let's just think about the opposition. They don't have to worry about elections, so they can do strategy. All our politicians are worried about elections. Whenever I talk to politicians at any level about these sorts of things, all I can see in their heads is how many votes.
Yeah.
Not one person is thinking beyond their next
election.
Yeah,
but what's the alternative to that? I mean, autocrats.
There is an alternative. You take certain things out of the democratic process and you give it to a committee of the Privy Council, or you give it to a Royal Commission. You say, look, we need to understand what the strategy for this country is for the next 25 years. So you might think health, energy, education, transport, defence. Take it out of the democratic process, get it sorted, cross-party, cross-cultural.
So you're talking like a hybrid technocrat democracy.
To the strategic level. And then you say to the elected politicians, you implement and resource it, and we'll give you 10% either side. 10% either side, okay, to vary, to put it into implementation. You can go 100% outside of it if you want, but if you screw it up, we'll impeach you.
Interesting idea.
And we have got to get into a position now where, as a state, we have to say long-term what our interest is.
But then isn't that the role of NATO? Because NATO is a regardless of the politicians changing, and we know that Central Europe is moving to the right and Britain seems to be moving to the left. Regardless, NATO is a stability with it as them governments change.
No, because unfortunately, you look at countries. If you say that the NATO threshold for sort of investment should be 2% of GDP, that should be mandatory. It shouldn't be voluntary. I've long said since the 90s, what NATO should do is say, look, this is what a credible defence costs. Members, you pay. It's as simple as that. You don't make it voluntary. You don't say to politicians when you can afford it. I keep saying to
people...
But
how would you answer the arguments that is it's not a racket? NATO is not a racket.
It's not like the EU, so QED.
But that's what they say, don't they? They say it's not a racket. We don't have to pay America to defend you. We're all allies.
Yeah, we're all allies, but we need to pay our share. I mean, you know, I keep saying to people, do you realise how much it would cost in a one-off to get European capability up to the level where we can resist and deter Russia? I mean, just have a think about it in your head. How much do you think it would cost? If America weren't here, how much would it cost in a one-off?
It would be impossible.
No, no, I've calculated it.
What, in billions or percentage of GDP?
No, no, all right, real money.
It's a one-off.
Okay, billion.
Well, I mean, it's got to be 500. Half a trillion or something.
Yeah, 500 billion.
That's very good. You're very close. Okay, it's 510 billion. Okay. Do you think that's a big number?
Yes, massive.
Okay, it's half the annual American defense budget.
Is it really?
So when the Americans see us going, you know, we can't spend 500 billion on our defense. Okay, they go, we spend that in 6 months. Okay, so don't even come near us.
And also, again, we spend it badly because we've got these aircraft carriers. One of them doesn't even work, does it, anymore? It's barely moving. You know, we've spent all this money. We spent all of Britain's procurement and large expenditure militarily seems to be over budget, delayed, and the delays make it obsolete before it comes out.
Andy, our procurement is a disgrace. There's no question about that. And the fact that nobody's gripped it is on the same scale as the post office scandal and everything else. I've got no illusions about that. You know, I've never been in procurement. The basic problem in defence is there is not a grip from cradle to grave on the process from the concept originally through to the delivery of the capability. Now, if I tell you that I did the original concept for the carriers, all right, and that concept...
So it's your fault?
No. The concept looks nothing like the carriers we've got today. So my concept for the carriers was... we need to make it a floating chunk of sovereignty that can do anything from carrying jets all the way through to humanitarian aid. And it was based around a 42,000 ton carrier with catapults and arrestor wires that would take F-18 aircraft, the same ones you see in Top Gun 2. And when we got the F-35s, then we would phase them in, and not the jump jet variant, the F-35B, but the carrier variant the Americans have got, the F-35C. Okay, and I'm afraid to say, when I left that project, okay, it was given to people who couldn't make up their minds whether they wanted it to be an aerial farm or a bird farm, and it got translated into what we've got today. These hugely overpriced aircraft that we've got on it, which we can't afford to put on it. They're good carriers, there's no question about that, but they're not the right carriers. And, dare I say it, they've been built to the sort of standards where you get faults. Like the propeller shafts have gone wrong. I sat next to Buzz Aldrin once at a dinner in called Tailhook in the United States. And I said to him, you know, what was the thing you remember about going to the moon in 1969? And I thought he'd be saying, yo, you know, we're looking back at the Earth and thinking what a tiny speck it is and all that sort of thing. And he said, no. He said, what we were doing, he said, we sat upside down in the capsule with about a minute to go before we blasted off. And Neil Armstrong said, do you realise, he said, every single component in this vehicle went to the lowest bidder. which actually sums it up, you know. Yeah. And I'm afraid to say, unless you keep a real grip on it, and I think it's the operators that need to keep a grip on procurement, it'll always go wrong. Because you always have a conflict between the pressures of time, capability, and resource. So people take shortcuts. I'll give you an example. We had a thing called the Type 42 destroyer. Some of them went down the Falklands, Sheffield, Coventry, Glasgow. And when it was first conceptualized, it was supposed to be the best anti-air and anti-aircraft platform around. And so it was going to have 42 missiles, it was going to have up-to-date radars, jammers, it was going to have a lightweight Seawolf close-in system, which was really good, a Lynx helicopter on the back. By the time it got into service, it had been pared down to 20 missiles, obsolete radars, no jammer, no close-in defence Seawolf, and a Wasp helicopter, which is a bit like a grass-cutting machine with a rotor on top compared to a modern aircraft. So, but here's the point. The ship that was sent down the Falklands was the one that we ended up with, but the people on the top had in their minds the first one that was sent down there, which is why we lost Sheffield and Coventry, and Glasgow got put out by a single bomb.
So how much damage have the Conservatives done then to our armed forces?
I wrote an article for the Telegraph in 2010 when we had the Strategic Defence and Security Review, which totally criticised the policy that was brought in there. I'm afraid to say that first defence review under Cameron Osborne gutted the armed forces going forward. It hollowed them out. And I said, my last line in that article was that I'm afraid the government know the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Well, the sales pitch to that was we can reduce down the number of soldiers that technology. We have because technology will take over. We're changing the armed forces for the 21st century.
Well, yeah. So this is why I think warfare is too important a subject to be left to politicians, frankly. No general, admiral or air marshal at the time is going to say no because their careers depended on it. And in peacetime, why risk it? And that's the problem. In wartime, you know, the people rise to the top that can actually speak truth to power. You don't get truth to power in peacetime because people's careers depend on it. I mean, I know this. My own career was the same. If you rock the boat, then you're going to be out. I nearly got sacked in every rank. I was lucky to survive, I can tell you.
So even in democracies, there's no real feedback loop. So we criticise that of Putin, like his generals don't tell the truth, but that's probably the same to a lesser degree here as well.
My PhD is in the psychology of military incompetence, and the features that actually make up for military incompetence translate into all sorts of corporate and political incompetence. It relates to flaws in character, perverse incentives, and things like that. And in peacetime, you don't have the pressure to actually make the right decisions. You can defer them, you can corrupt them, you can actually reverse them if you want to. You're never, ever going to be held to account. I'll give an example from the great financial crash of 2008-09. Afterwards, I was teaching leadership to a group of bankers, heads of banks, heads of building societies. And I said, look, you know, I was involved in futures in my last job in the Navy, and we saw the financial crash coming. Why didn't you? And they said, well, we did, but nobody wants to come out with the market still going up. You know, yeah. Your shareholders get upset. And they said, here's the critical thing. They said, and of course, if everybody's wrong, nobody's wrong, which is why we're still in our jobs.
Yeah.
And I made the point, well, in my sector, we're all dead on the battlefield. You know, it doesn't quite work like that. And that's the problem. You get perverse incentives. You get the herd mentality. And anybody, I'm afraid, who says the emperor's not wearing any clothes, I'm afraid, gets moved aside.
Just on that point, because you again, going back to the politics a little bit, you obviously talked about 2010 and Cameron. How have the Conservatives performed on defence since then?
Well, there's no votes in defence since then. It's not a critical issue. So they basically have diluted and hollowed out our armed forces. They've also introduced several social measures, which I'm afraid to say take front and centre.
Is that the gender quotas?
Any quota system or I'm afraid affirmative action depletes a fighting force. All the studies say that diversity in terms of neurodiversity is healthy in military structures. I'm afraid having diversity for its own sake does not actually add any fighting capability whatsoever. And indeed, all the studies that I've seen, reputable studies, say that diverse fighting units perform less well than those who are not. But let me stress, neurodiversity is fine and encouraged.
And what type of diversity are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about, if you're saying, look, we've got to have 20% of our fighting force women, or indeed people from sort of ethnic minorities, there is no evidence that that will give you a better fighting force, other than for the neurodiversity point of view. Diversity is a means, not an end in itself. And this is where it's gone wrong in the armed forces, in my view, and it is only my view, okay? You shouldn't be pushing for diversity for its own sake. You push for diversity because it adds to your fighting capability and perhaps cultural understanding of your opponents and where you're fighting.
Not diversity for diversity's sake.
Correct. And so you're seeing, again, I get back to my military incompetence point about perverse incentives. It's quite extraordinary. Mm. So if you are rewarding people simply and promoting them or pushing them forward simply because they're increasing your diversity then it's not increasing your fighting capability. But let me stress, the major damage has been done since 2010 by successive conservative governments not taking the context and the threat seriously. So under Cameron and Osborne, China was our friend. It was the golden age when all of us who knew about these things were saying, "No, one of the, let me tell you."
Well, we got lulled into a false sense of security, didn't we? We haven't really been at war. We've had wars in the Middle East, which we can easily win. There's been no threat.
John, it's a good point. Democracies are really good at total war. They're really good at it because they can generate all the human and other material resources that are necessary. In limited wars, they're not great because they play at it. And I'm afraid the British public has seen wars in the 21st century as something they look at on the TV.
Yeah.
They read about, they get interested in. We throw a bit of blood and treasure at it, but it's over there. And we expect to get success out of it. Well, guess what? We didn't in Afghanistan and Iraq. Why? Because it was over there. There was no strategy in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'm afraid to say that one of the biggest problems we've had in the last 25 years, I would say, is that we've had politicians who have been unable to understand how to threaten or use force.
And can I just come up, because I just want to finish off this section on British politics. So obviously, we've got a general election now. Sunak's talked about 3%. Labour haven't, and neither have said much on defence. We're likely to have a Labour government. Does that fill you full of confidence or fear?
I really don't know. What I do worry about is that very many of the potential Labour front bench, for example, are late converts to our nuclear deterrent. In fact, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has said it's against his conscience to even consider being part of a government that has nuclear weapons. But suddenly he's a convert.
Yes.
And I'm afraid to say that in this world, if you doubt the value of nuclear weapons in confronting, let's have a look, China, Russia, North Korea, all of which have nuclear weapons, and Iran, who soon will have a nuclear weapon, then you're on cloud cuckoo.
Well, we heard last week that the amount of enriched uranium Iran had has rapidly increased.
There's no doubt Iran. Let's look back at the JCPOA, the thing that was supposed to shackle Iran, which was introduced by Obama, probably the weakest geopolitical president of the last 50 years. He actually said you can have a nuclear device after 12 years.
Yeah.
So when is that? 2027. So the Iranians are going, that's okay. Regime's a bit shaky here in Iran. So it's a race between us getting our nuclear weapon and our population saying, you know what, we're really fed up with you. So the real. I should stress, by the way, that geopolitically, all our opponents feel very insecure, whether it's the Chinese Communist Party, the Kremlin regime, the Iranian regime, or North Korea. They feel really insecure. And the biggest motivator for war on their part is that they will externalize their internal problems. So whenever China has a problem internally, they externalize. Russia's the same. Ukraine's part of that. When the Kremlin regime was wobbling a bit, they projected outwards. North Korea, I'm going to forecast for you, will really put the pressure on South Korea later this year as part of that, because the regime there at the moment is feeling a bit unstable. Iran is highly unstable right now. You've got infighting amongst the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the Ministry of Intelligence. You've just had Raisi killed in the helicopter crash. Ayatollah Khomeini is about to die at some stage. The succession crisis will destabilize. And you have 75% of your population under 35. It's a powder keg. So they're all very worried about their survival. And in all of those sorts of regimes, if you don't survive, you tend to end up dead.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's good to start a war. So do you think Trump then, because lots of people say that Trump coming in will actually end NATO, he's going to turn it into a racket and he'll pull out. My personal opinion is I really want Trump to come back. The world was at peace. There was peace. He didn't take any rubbish from North Korea. China was quiet. Russia was quiet. Is he going to come back and just sort all this out?
Well, it's interesting because I'm running one of my future scenarios, which says that neither Trump nor Biden will run in November.
Well, so that is some prediction.
Forecast. Well, it's a forecast. Oh, okay. I don't predict.
But it is a possibility. Listen, Biden can't put a word together, and there's still court cases going on with Trump.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. I mean, right. if Trump falls by the wayside, Nikki Haley's staying in the fight at the moment. She's not saying I concede. So she's saying, you know, if Trump stumbles, I'm there to take over. Now, the other thing is I have a suspicion that Biden is just holding the seat warm for somebody else.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
And I think that if Nikki Haley does step in as the Republican candidate, and I think she's the most likely, the Democrats have to put a woman up against her.
Well, let's assume for the purpose of this conversation
that... That'd be Hillary, then.
No, it won't be.
No, wait, won't be?
No, I mean, my forecast is that they will pick Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, if that's the case.
Right.
If all this happens, okay? But you're right, Trump may make it, okay? It's quite interesting. In Trump's first term, I used to speak to Russian and Chinese academics, and they said, how do you play Trump? And I said, well, you don't. He's not a politician. He's a businessman, and he knows his way around. They would say, but it's not fair. We could play Bush, Clinton, Obama, and this and the other. I'm paraphrasing. And I said, no. And his perceived unpredictability was a real strategic asset for the United States.
Is that too dangerous now, though, unpredictability?
No. I mean, I'm afraid to say that Western politicians are highly predictable. You look at Xi Jinping, you look at Putin and his mates, and all the other, they're all three steps ahead. Every time. As I said, our people can't actually play the game anymore. If you look at the American politicians and officials, and indeed our own in the 1950s, they all had experience of total war and how to threaten and use force. And they were really good as statesmen. And we've lost statecraft. As I said earlier, we've got a situation where they're so obsessed by electoral politics that they can't actually make the big decisions anymore.
Well, it's actually frowned upon as well, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but you go back in the Conservative Party...
You're looked as uncollaborative and aggressive and...
Well, but you don't have to be any of these things. You just have to be smart. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I've run information campaigns in the past, and it's all about saying, OK, how can I position and shape my opponent in information terms... 1 week hence, 1 month hence. How can I... I mean, one of the big things that I've been advocating recently is that we need some sort of political military unit, and I call it the comprehensive approach. You bring together all organs and instruments of government and state that run strategic issues at tactical pace.
But that's never going to happen.
Well, it can happen.
But it doesn't happen in any Western democracy because the politicians won't let go of the power that
Correct.
They have.
Correct. It's very interesting you say that because... When we had the Ukraine war come up, I said you need a real war cabinet of people who have no political interest in actually what happens. And you know, to actually say, this is our strong recommendation, so you make the decision. One of the best lessons I ever learned, actually...
Although you say that, let's look at COVID. They had something quite similar with COVID, and that was a complete disaster.
Well, but there was no strategy, Andy. You know, we had a situation...
No, but they had a committee of experts listened to.
No, they didn't have a committee of experts. They had a committee of very narrow experts. Okay, where were the historians, the sociologists? I can tell you, I've studied every epidemic from the Black Death through to Saturday Night Fever. And right at the start of COVID, I said the lessons from every single epidemic we've had are you isolate the sick and those looking after them, you screen the vulnerable, you take reasonable precautions about personal hygiene, and you carry on. You don't lock down. Those are the lessons. So where was the historian in that group of experts that was telling them that? It didn't exist. I'm afraid it was a very narrow, self-regarding group of experts. And you ended up, I'm afraid, with a situation that where if you try and run a state like a business rather than as a society, you're going to exclude all the sorts of things that will actually deal with a society. I've always objected to running human sort of issues along business lines because we're imperfect. We've actually got emotions as everything
else. I'd agree on one point that actually, I mean, politicians these days don't seem to be getting very good advice. Again, Rishi Sunak's entire, premiership has been run by children in the corridors of 10 Downing Street.
If you surround yourself with loyalists and flatterers, no organisation can survive. it becomes a self-licking lollipop. And suddenly it doesn't relate to anything on the outside. I mean, my issue is, if you go back into history, really good leaders do two things. A-grade leaders surround themselves with A-plus people, that's the first thing, and they're able to tolerate and encourage dissent. That's not what happens. I'm afraid I haven't seen any government
Well, that's certainly not Trump, though, is it?
Not true. That is not true. Trump is able to tolerate dissent up to a point where he says, it's actually my train set.
Right.
And I get to make the decision. But that's not the case entirely with Trump.
But this is Trump 2.0. Remember, he doesn't have to get re-elected. He can't stand again.
He wants a legacy, though.
And he does, but that
all sins forgiven. You know, he wants a legacy. Believe me. Look, Trump's a narcissist. Okay, and if you look at the psychological personality, they're desperate about what people think about them, to the point of saying, "Well, actually, it's everybody else's fault, not mine."
Yeah.
Henry VIII's a narcissist. If you look back in history, it's always somebody else's fault. But he will want a legacy, a powerful legacy, if not for his dynasty even. He may even want little Trumps coming on after him.
No, but if you were a Cameroon, that would have been war. With Trump, it's peace.
Yeah, but the problem is that I'm afraid in all political structures, loyalty and both within your immediate vicinity. I mean, I was talking recently to a senior conservative and I said, look, why is it that Rishi Sunak, for example, and remember, I'm not a politician, okay? I'm a military man looking at it from a practical point of view. Why didn't Rishi Sunak earlier in the year, when he did his reshuffle, clear everybody out and say, we really messed up over the last 14 years and it's your fault?
He's not strong enough.
Well, he's a prime minister. He can do what he likes. And people will follow the shepherd. If only they provide leadership. Should have put people in who were proven people who could deliver and said, by a November election, which I would have recommended, not a July one, I want each of you in your department to have delivered something really serious. Home Office, stop the boats. Because you stop the boats, you win the election. Every other department should have been given something to deliver that was really nationally significant. Okay, so I'm talking to a senior Conservative ex-minister about this. Why did that not happen? It didn't happen because I'm afraid that David Cameron and George Osborne were trying to secure the succession for George Osborne. So they cut away anybody who was a threat to that.
And what do you think George Osborne is coming back into mainstream politics?
No, I don't. Before. But I think he was at one stage. The succession was being smoothed, I'm afraid. And he said, look, so anybody who was a threat was actually pushed away and not encouraged to actually deliver anything. And then in the 2019 election, we were so desperate for candidates, we were actually bringing people in who weren't really Conservatives. Well,
that's happening now.
So, you know, why on earth do we think that the Conservatives can retain the loyalty of people in this country when they don't project Conservative?
Well, there's a couple of things I want to talk to you about. So, about the conscription plan, but I just want to take you back to stopping the boats. It's slightly off topic, but we've heard politicians saying the Navy can't stop the boats. So I just wanted to ask you, could they have used the Navy to stop the small boats?
Yeah, of course they can use the Navy to stop the boats.
How would that have worked?
Well, look, it's got to be...
Because we're going to get someone on the show and we can say, well, actually, you're talking rubbish.
No, look, you know, it's a simple barrier operation. The issue is the political and legal will and courage to actually do something about it. I put a plan in for stopping the boats to the Home Office 5 years ago. It's been totally ignored.
What was it?
I'd rather keep it secret, but the issue is lies around all you are committed to doing if you pick somebody up at sea is to take them to a place of safety.
And that could be France.
Could be all sorts of places. It could be a former liner positioned in international waters between Britain and France. You can also declare the channel a humanitarian zone, where normal laws and conventions can be suspended in order to ensure it doesn't become a problem. Okay, there are all sorts of issues, but there's no political will or courage to do anything about it. I happen to know that plan was resubmitted in November last year to the Cabinet Office. It never came out.
And the plan, believe me, making it into a humanitarian corridor?
No, you simply say we have a humanitarian crisis here, and it's one that is going to be replicated the world over. It's not just in the English Channel. We'd like to be the exemplars of how that happens. The fact of life is you should be processing people offshore. You shouldn't be bringing them to the UK. And frankly, if you've got the Rwanda scheme in place, if you take them, for example, to a liner, X-liner, where you can accommodate them, you can process them. Okay, if they don't qualify, they don't have a passport, you're off to Rwanda.
Yeah.
I mean, all these things are possible.
And could the Navy have intercepted these boats?
The Navy, of course, could have intercepted them.
Well, the French Navy is escorting them halfway across the Channel.
Well, let me tell you, in the Mediterranean, the Royal Navy was intercepting and picking up people. It's as simple as that. It can be done. You know, the fact of life, what you can't do...
That's a really fair point. Again, the government lauded the work of the Royal Navy in the Mediterranean. You mean stopping these boats?
Well, they weren't stopping them. They were picking people up and then processing them. So why can't we do it in the English Channel? It's ridiculous.
So you couldn't push them back? You couldn't say you're not having entry?
I think you've got a problem in actually forcing people back. There's all sorts of ways you can get around it. But here's the point. You just have to take them to a place of safety. That's what the international law says. It doesn't say take them to the UK. But the problem is, if you treat everything like a wicked problem, then you're never going to solve it. But I would say to you, there's been no political will or courage to do anything about it.
No,
of course it's possible. It's ridiculous. Let's just say there were drug runners. Do you think we'd stop them? I think we would.
Yeah.
So if we can stop drug runners in the Caribbean, I'm sure we can stop migrant boats coming. I mean, my biggest bleat about these things is if you come and cross our border without a passport or any means of identification, you've immediately broken the law anyway. You try doing that at Heathrow.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And you've paid a human trafficker as well.
I've got a problem with this stress on the traffickers. The traffickers are only there because there's a business model.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we need to deal with the perpetrators. If you want to solve the drugs problem in the UK, you start hammering people who use the drugs.
Yeah.
But there's no political will or courage to do that either.
Yeah, but they've paid the human trafficker. So
doesn't matter. Yeah. You're still breaking the law.
Exactly, that's what I mean.
But as far as I'm concerned, you know, unless you break the business model, in other words, you take away the demand, then you're never going to deal with this. It's the same with drugs.
Well, we'll say that next time we hear a Conservative MP, so the Navy can...
Of course it can. The Navy can do what you want it to do, but you've got to give it... One of the interesting things that... I learnt after the Falklands is I had lunch with Margaret Thatcher, because she said, look, come and have lunch. I want a representative sample of people who fought. I sat next to her for the pudding course, and I thought, what on earth am I going to talk to her about? Because, you know, she quite, don't want to be handbagged. and I said to her, what did you learn from the war? And she said, well, you tell me first. And I said, well, I learned that actually I could do it. Because first real conflict, I've been in Northern Ireland, but it's the first real conflict where the metal and body parts are flying around I've been in. And so I learned I could do it. I said, but what did you learn? And she said, what I learned was that what I have to do is give my political outcomes to my military leaders. I mustn't try and give them military outcomes. And that's probably the smartest thing I've heard in 40 years to do with warfare, is that if you ask military leaders to deliver political outcomes, then it will work. But if you go into Afghanistan and Iraq and don't give your military leaders the political outcomes, nothing's going to happen. Mm. There's no strategy at all. But it's a really smart point. So what are the political outcomes that the government wants in the Channel is my question. What are the political outcomes they want? Nobody knows that. I've never seen it expressed. So before you deploy the military in anything, you have to establish what the political outcomes are.
They have to be realistic, though, because Israel will destroy Hamas, and that's probably not possible.
It is possible. We destroyed the Nazis.
Yeah.
But there's still Nazism now.
Yeah, but they're not Nazis who dress up in Hitler uniforms and are German and
they're
all that
no
sort
threat,
of thing.
Are they?
You know,
just pockets
at the end of the
weirdos.
Day, if you want to destroy an ideology, you go and extirpate it where it's based. And that's, you know, if we're talking about Gaza, let's have a look at the political objectives over and above whatever Benjamin Netanyahu wants personally. The political objectives are that Israel wants to free the hostages, because it's obviously a big domestic issue. They want to eradicate Hamas, because they don't want them coming back again. and they want to establish the conditions for future peace and stability. Now, right now, the only people who have a plan for that are the Israelis. People who say to me, ceasefire, ceasefire, that's not a solution, because it doesn't deliver any of those three whatsoever. Nobody has a plan beyond a ceasefire. It's like saying, we'll go into Iraq and not have a plan for what happens afterwards.
Well, yeah.
But there was a plan. John, there was a plan. It just wasn't taken up by the Americans. We Brits had a plan for what happened afterwards. Mm. Again, you know, you've got to look at these things strategically. But, you know, when you look at Israel, only Israel has a plan. Nobody else. If somebody comes to Israel now and says, I can deliver your political objectives without you having to go into Gaza and destroying Hamas, then the Israelis will listen to it. But shouting ceasefire all the time ain't going to give you peace. And I'm afraid to say that all these obstructions in the way of the Israeli defense forces are actually perpetuating the crisis and increasing the number of casualties. If they're allowed to get on and do the job and destroy Hamas, there'll be less casualties, I almost guarantee it.
Okay, so we've obviously talked about Russia and the...
We're going to go to conscription.
Yeah, you can go.
What do you think about the conscription idea then?
Well, it's national service, of course.
Yeah.
So it's a broader, more comprehensive issue. I fundamentally believe that nowadays we do need to actually have some sort of way of linking our armed forces to our society in the event of total war.
Yeah.
If we're involved in total war, we need to access that. I think there are other ways of doing it. Right now, I haven't seen the details of the plan. All I'm certain...
There aren't any details. That's why you haven't seen them.
Well, indeed. But the fact of life is, in terms of concept, I've got no problem with the concept. What I do have a problem with is the implementation. And anything that detracts from the fighting capability of the current armed forces and what we want to grow them into is to be avoided.
Well, how are the armed forces and their current numbers going to be able to look after and kind of train 30,000 complete beginners?
We can't even train the current people coming in at the moment without delays. We don't have the resources in manpower, accommodation, and logistics to do this. There's no question. And I think it's laughable to think it's just going to cost $2.5 billion to implement it in the armed forces.
Well, first of all, you've got to build up the army big enough to deal with it, and that's going to cost more than $2.5 billion anyway.
We don't have the instructors. There's all sorts of issues associated with this. That, you know, it's like anything. Big ideas have got to be followed up with a comprehensive plan. And you also got to shake people's perceptions. To actually pull it out of the bag like a white rabbit like that is ridiculous.
It is.
My worry is that what we're going to end up is what looks like a gap year paid for by the taxpayer.
And actually, I don't know if you saw, there was a written question to the defense secretary or one of his underlings the week before, and they replied back.
Murison said no chance.
They said there's no plan to do this, and then next week they're announcing it.
So in principle, you like the sentiment of it.
I like the idea of being
able to... But you think it's a gimmick?
Right now, until I see the detail, it's something to distract people. There's no question about it. I think the idea of national service is good. National service across the board. I think there's a great ability, like all sorts of other schemes, for young people to give them additional skills. But let's be certain, with regard to the armed forces, unless it adds to the fighting capability of the armed forces, you're wasting their time. It's as simple as that. It just becomes a means rather than an end again.
Yeah.
You know, and what are we trying to achieve here? You know, throughout my career, I've seen the armed forces as a fantastic social mobility engine. I've seen people taken from sinker states and the most abusive backgrounds and turned into the most amazing achieving adults. It's good for that. But that's not its primary role. No. Its primary role is to deter the king's enemies and to defeat them. Anything that detracts from that, I'm afraid, will weaken our armed forces. You know, we're not going to be childminders in the future. We need to be able to fight, as I said, the nation's enemies. Excuse me.
So we can't defend ourselves. We don't spend enough.
We can defend ourselves because we're in NATO and we've got the United States.
Okay. Can Europe defend itself on its own?
Mm-mm.
No.
Against whom?
Russia.
No.
Okay.
China.
No. And when Russia... If Russia decides it wants to fire the same missiles that it's fired against Ukraine at Western Europe, we've got no defences to deal with that.
Yeah, so we need an iron dome or something.
Well, that's just fanciful. You can't have, again, the iron dome is there.
We've got a lot.
Iron dome is there so that Israel can take the hits without fighting back. Again, an iron dome isn't an offensive weapon. It's not even a defensive weapon. Again, you're just allowing your enemy to continue to attack you.
But bear in mind that Iron Dome is just part of the layered defence that they've got. Yeah. I mean, you've got the arrow system above it. You've got David's sling. There's all sorts of other things that complement that we have to take into account. And let's just remember, Israel's quite a small place. One of the reasons it has to defend itself like that, it's got no strategic depth. Has to fight on other... And look what happens if you have the enemy on your territory. You end up with the 7th of October stuff. So you can't allow them inside your borders. Now, the real problem for us is that, if you're up against totalitarian states, you have to have some way of gaining the initiative to give you deterrence. Throughout the 30s, we never had the initiative because our political will and courage wasn't there. So Hitler said, I'll get back into the Rhineland, I'll take over Austria, I'll take over Czechoslovakia.
And it feels very similar now than it did in the 30s. It's entirely similar.
Because we are appeasing, we are not actually deterring.
I just want to quickly run through how a war with Russia might start. Okay. Because it seems to be that there seems to be this theory that it's going to be sequential. Like they're going to go for Ukraine and then they might go for Estonia or, Moldova or even Poland. But I'm not a military person. But my suspicion would be that it's not going to do that. If he wants to do it, Putin, he's going to try to spook NATO by challenging us so that we actually then divert attention away from our resources away from Ukraine and actually hoard them back into NATO. Could something like that happen?
We're at war with Russia now. Nobody's realised it. You're looking at cyber attacks consistently now. We've had two nerve agent attacks on this country by Russia. We're in a very low level, what they call gray zone level of conflict. And we're not taking it seriously. Now, if we took that seriously, we'd be able to deter the hard stuff. Now, if a war were to start with Russia right now, you'd see sporadic confrontations, what I call encounter actions, along that ragged line between Russia and Europe. So you'd see probably an armed confrontation between Air Force jets. You might see a confrontation at sea. You might see border incursions. You see subversion of, say, the Baltic states or Finland or something like that. You'd see massive pushes of migrants across the Norwegian border, which we've seen already. All these sorts of things, shorts of war. Nothing big enough to provoke a general war, but actually to stoke things up. You'd see attempts at de-escalation. The Russians would simply say, well, actually, that encourages us a bit more. And you see a progressive erosion of what I call the NATO border and indeed our infrastructure. I'm one of those that believes firmly that Russia blew the Nord Stream pipeline. They've got the capability. They had the motive to do it. So,
are you saying then that would erode Article 5? Because if they're encroaching in NATO, but actually there's not an activation of Article 5, we don't just automatically push back.
Let's look at Article 5. Article 5 commits countries to consult each other about what needs to be done. There's this idea that somehow it's a trigger alert. All in. Attack on one is an attack on all. Yes, that in principle that's true, but in fact it commits you to consulting together about what needs to be done. Now, Article 5, there's no doubt that if NATO territory were invaded by the formed forces of the Russian Federation, that would lead to general war.
Yeah.
However, if you have a number of anonymous, deniable actions taking place along NATO's border and within its societies, is that going to lead to Article 5? I doubt it. Let me give you an example. What happens if an underwater unmanned vehicle detonates against the side of one of our nuclear submarines? Who did it?
Well, there's deniability, isn't there?
Who did it?
Yeah.
That's what you're going to see. You're going to see a whole series of deniable, debatable and dodgy actions taking place where you can't actually say, you definitely did it. The very fact we're talking about the Nord Stream pipeline issue shows you how difficult it is.
Yeah.
I mean, you even had a reputable journalist in the United States blaming the Americans for doing it. Absolutely ridiculous situation. But at the end of the day, we've got to build up a more comprehensive capability within our society and state for dealing with these strategic threats at every level of engagement. Now, one of the biggest problems we've got in democracies, again, is we don't bring together all our instruments of state to deal with this. So we have to say, as a society, we are now confronting these totalitarian states. What do we have to do that? So in the national service issue, there's actually something quite interesting. So they're saying, look, we're going to employ some of our youngsters in cyber operations. Great, because they're good at gaming, they're good at computers. We'll employ you for a year confronting the Russians and Chinese.
Yeah.
But we have to vet you. That's going to actually take a while, isn't it? And it's all going to cost us. So people aren't thinking through the detail. But do we want to galvanise the resources of our society in order to confront this societal threat? Yes, we do. And the mechanisms for doing that is what the government should be leading us on.
Great.
Well, listen, that was
fascinating.
That was absolutely fascinating. And actually, the topics you've just added to, it's probably another podcast in itself.
Okay, I'll come back.
That would be really kind.
Thank you very much.